Okay, so lastly, we're going to hear from Dr. Pat Harrington, who works for the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. Dr. Harrington got his bachelor degree in microbiology from Clemson University, and before going on to graduate school, worked for Baxter, doing some scientific work, and also for the American Red Cross. He ended up getting his PhD and also his postdoc, both from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, working on microbiology and virology, and also working on vaccine development. He went on to work as an assistant professor, again, at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill School of Medicine, at the Department of Microbiology and Immunology, and again studied novel vaccine design. At the FDA, he works as a clinical microbiology reviewer. He reviews, instead of grants, he reviews data and protocol and provides advice to companies and researchers concerning virology.
Thank you, and thank you all for staying for the last talk. I'm going to spend a little bit less time about how to apply for a job at FDA and just more sort of what the position is about, because I think it's kind of a mystery to a lot of people. It was a mystery to me until I really started my job, actually. But with that said, I will borrow what Rebecca was mentioning about applying to NIH. Really, those same concepts apply to the same goes for applying to FDA. You go through USA Jobs and all the same things, all the fine details of going through all that process, very similar to applying for NIH. And I'll also borrow Jason's disclaimer. The views in this presentation are those of myself and not necessarily official policy of FDA. So I'll just give a little history of U.S. drug regulation, some background on FDA organization, the drug development and review process from the FDA perspective, the role of an FDA reviewer, my career path, and finally just a little bit about pay benefits and career development opportunities. So I thought just to give you an idea about sort of how FDA came into existence in the federal government, I thought it would help to sort of give you a brief history of U.S. drug regulation. And like most major milestones in the federal government, the major milestones in U.S. drug regulation followed major public crises. So when you talk about the history of drug regulation, you also have to talk about the public health incidents that sort of led to changes in the way that the federal government regulates drugs. So a lot of this history begins in the early 1900s. So I'll just start in 1901 with the story of the horse named Jim. So Jim was a horse that was used to produce diphtheria antitoxin. And it turns out that Jim himself was infected with tetanus. And the veterinarians recognized this. They put Jim down, but for some reason left the antitoxin on the market. And as a result, several people got infected with tetanus, and it ultimately led to the deaths of 13 children. So this incident led to the passage of the 1902 Biologics Control Act, which was passed to ensure purity and safety of serums, vaccines, and similar products. And then there was some additional legislation in the early 1900s, such as the 1906 Food and Drugs Act and the 1912 Shirley Amendment. And these were passed mainly to target the misbranding or mislabeling or adulteration of foods and drugs. So one of those products that was targeted by this legislation was Mrs. Winslow's soothing syrup. And this is just an example of some of the things that, that was actually being sold at the time on the U.S. drug market. So Mrs. Winslow's soothing syrup was sold as a drug for teething children. So you can imagine the size of that market. People didn't really know what they were giving their babies at the time. You know, it wasn't appropriately labeled like you know, would look at a drug label today. It turns out that the active ingredients in Mrs. Winslow's soothing syrup were alcohol and morphine. So as a result, it led to, of course, many babies were soothed, but others were in comas. They were addicted to alcohol or morphine, and many also died as well. So, and this is just an example of some of the crazy stuff that was being sold at the time. So be glad you weren't a baby at that time. So another major milestone was the 1938 Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, and this was passed in response to just really a disaster in 1937 with the elixir of sulfanilamide. So Sulfanilamide at the time was a reasonably safe and effective antibacterial drug, but there was a need for a liquid form of it. And I guess it didn't dissolve very easily in your traditional solution, so some chemist had the bright idea of dissolving it in diethylene glycol, which is chemically similar to antifreeze and also has a very nice fruity flavor, apparently. And there was no toxicity testing required at the time, no system to recall the product immediately, and as a result, it led to, very quickly led to the deaths of hundreds of people, because it was essentially poison at this point. So this led to the passage of the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, which basically established what we now call the FDA. It required new drugs to be shown safe before somebody could actually sell those on the U.S. market. It didn't have to be beneficial at the time, but at least had to be proven safe. And then in 1962, there was the thalidomide disaster, which, so thalidomide was a pill that was used to treat morning sickness in pregnant women. Again, a huge market. An FDA medical officer was actually credited in keeping the drug off the U.S. market because she was skeptical of its safety, and for good reason. It ended up being used a little bit in the U.S. through investigational use, but it was used more widespread in Western Europe and led to just really horrific, severe birth defects in thousands of babies. And if this topic interests you at all, if you just Google search thalidomide and look at some of the pictures that come up, it's really horrific. And this is a picture of one of those babies where it's missing part of its arm and has like this kind of funky appendage growing out of its foot. So it's just one of the another example of some of the things that can happen with poor drug regulation. And this led to the passage of the 1962 Kefauver-Harris drug amendments. And this expanded the safety requirements for drugs that are on the U.S. market. But even more importantly, as a milestone, for the first time, it now required drug manufacturers to prove efficacy to the FDA before marketing. Now, in the thalidomide disaster wasn't really an efficacy issue, but it did sort of change the public perception on the need for better drug regulation, and that allowed this amendment to pass. So based on the 1938 and the 1962 legislation, we now have the standard that we still use today at the FDA, which basically requires that any new drug to be sold on the U.S. market must first be proven to the FDA to be both safe and effective. So today's FDA is organized into 7 major centers. I am in the Center for Drug Evaluation and Research. And within CDER is the Office of New Drugs. And the Office of New Drugs is broken down further into smaller offices. And then within those offices, it's broken down into the individual review divisions. So these review divisions are organized by therapeutic area. And this is where all the primary reviews occur. So this is where all the scientists review the data that companies send to us. So I'm in the Division of Antiviral Products within the Office of Antimicrobial Products. And I put this whole chart up here just to give you a sense that it is, you know, there are tons of review divisions. There are different scientific disciplines, and I'll tell you about my experience, but just keep in mind that some of the specifics may vary in the different review divisions, and especially in the different FDA centers. So what do we review? We review basically anything that's like an antiviral drug. So your traditional antiviral drugs that are being developed or already approved for hepatitis C virus, HIV. We review immune modulators that are being developed to treat diseases that are caused by viral infections. We sort of serve as consultants for other divisions when antiviral-related issues come up. We cover the microbicides to prevent HIV transmission, drugs that are being developed for biodefense purposes, and also what we call the therapeutic biologics. And these are your interferons, monoclonal antibodies for treatment or prevention of viral infections. So to give you a sense of what we do on a day-to-day basis, I thought I would just sort of summarize how FDA fits in the drug development path. So we don't really, as an FDA reviewer, we don't really come into play until the preclinical side of things. Of course, we have to be familiar with the basic fundamentals, but our direct role doesn't really come into play until somebody wants to develop a specific product and test that product in humans. And our initial interactions with the drug sponsor usually begin when that sponsor submits to us a pre-investigational new drug submission. And this is actually an optional step as far as interactions go between drug sponsors and the FDA. But it allows the drug sponsor to get some initial feedback on some of the studies that they've conducted, or whether additional studies may be necessary before we feel comfortable, before they can go into a clinical trial. And then the clinical phase begins officially when a company submits to us a new investigational new drug submission. And so a new IND could be, in some cases, can be for a drug that has already been given to humans, possibly to treat another disease, or maybe it's been tested in other countries or something like that. But for the most part, the new IND is for a compound that has never been given to humans. It's never been tested in humans. So it includes all the key data from preclinical development to support that initial clinical trial. And then it also includes the first clinical trial protocol for testing this drug in humans for the first time. So at this point, we have to make a decision whether that protocol is safe to proceed or not. And if it's not safe to proceed from our perspective, then we have to inform the sponsor that, you know, maybe they need to do some additional toxicity testing, maybe they need to make the compound more pure, maybe they need to just revise the protocol to lower the doses, or, you know, there may be a number of different things that have to be modified before they can test it in clinical trials. But even after that step, we have continuous interactions between the drug sponsor and FDA, and we sort of go through this cycle over and over again throughout the different phases of clinical development. And then when a sponsor feels that they have sufficient data to support approval of their drug, they submit to us an NDA, or a new drug application. And this is, of course, a huge package. It includes final study reports from their preclinical phase of development and all the clinical studies that they've done to date. It also includes their proposed drug labeling, which will essentially form the basis for their marketing and advertising, and whatever else is needed really to support approval according to current FDA regulations. So again, we have to make a major decision at this point, and then even after a drug is approved, we can still get some post-approval submissions, just sort of depending on the situation. So to take it a little bit further and kind of give you a sense of what it's like, on a day-to-day basis, I'm going to try to present kind of an analogy here. And people ask me all the time, what do you do as an FDA reviewer? And you're not really trained in any of this in graduate school or postdoc. So I think the best way for me to explain it is it's kind of like a journal club, but a really intense, never-ending journal club, and potentially with public health implications, so it sort of adds another stress level to the journal club. So kind of going through using the journal club analogy, well, typically you'll get the paper if you're going to present a journal club article. You get to choose the paper. Well, we don't get to choose what we get, but what happens is the sponsor submits a document to us. So that document can be a non-clinical study report, can be a clinical study report, can be combinations of various materials, and it can be all sorts of different things that we have to review. Well, then, of course, you need to read the paper. For us, we, of course, read the materials, and we assess the study findings. We analyze the data, assess the methods, consider supporting literature, consider previous reviews of that product or similar products, and all to sort of get a sense of how that data fits into the total package of what we're reviewing. Well, if you're going to present a journal club article, you probably take some notes as you're reading the paper. For us, we write up a review. This is a little bit more detailed than just notes, but sometimes it's not much more detailed than just notes. We then send our review to a team leader, and this is within our same scientific discipline, and this is for concurrence or modification. So essentially, the team leader gives kind of a secondary review. So I'm a primary reviewer. The team leader sort of does a secondary review just to make sure that, maybe I missed something or maybe he disagrees with something that I suggested. So we come to some kind of concurrence with that, and then we archive and finalize that review. So then in journal club, you then present the paper. So for us, the way we present our review is we communicate our conclusions and recommendations to a multidisciplinary scientific review team. And this can be in a format of a very formal meeting, could just be an informal discussion, could just be something as simple as an email. It just sort of, again, depends on the context of the issue. And then a lot of times at the end of a journal club, you may discuss the path forward. So for us, this is where the multidisciplinary review team has to come to a consensus. And, you know, this isn't always easy. This can take months sometimes to come to a consensus on a particular issue. But eventually we have to come to a consensus on something and then maybe communicate recommendations to a drug sponsor or, you know, whether a drug's approved or not approved and that kind of thing. So, just a little bit about the multidisciplinary review team. So multiple scientific disciplines go into the review process. And this is just kind of the minimal members of the multidisciplinary review team. And this can vary a little bit by review division, but like I said, this is kind of the minimum. Generally, depending on the issue, you may have additional members of that review team. Say if it's a drug for pediatric purposes, you may have a pediatrician come in, or you know, various other scientific backgrounds may come in and weigh in on a particular issue. But in general, you always have a chemist. The chemist reviews data on drug manufacturing, stability, purity, packaging, that kind of thing. The toxicologist reviews the animal safety data. This is usually their efforts are mostly at the preclinical stage. So they'll review the animal safety data and make recommendations on the doses to carry forward into clinical trials, maybe identify some safety issues to watch out for in the clinical trials. And then you have the biologist or microbiologist. Sometimes this is just called a pharmacologist. So this is where I am. I'm officially a microbiologist. This person reviews the mechanism of action data, the drug target data, the off-target effects, and for antimicrobials, like antivirals. We also review the mechanisms of drug resistance. That's a major part of our efforts. And then you have a clinical pharmacologist. This person reviews, of course, anything pharmacology-related, relationships between in vivo exposures and safety or efficacy. They may review data on drug-drug interactions, how doses should be modified for specific patient populations, and so on. And then you have a biostatistician. The biostatistician generally comes in later in clinical development, and they play an important role in ensuring that the larger phase 3 clinical trials are appropriately designed from a statistics perspective and that they're adequately powered to demonstrate safety or efficacy. And then this person will also do the final statistical evaluation of efficacy or safety for those larger phase 3 trials that are used to support drug approval. And then you always have a medical officer. The medical officer is usually an MD in the group. Not always, but usually an MD. This person basically has the responsibility of monitoring drug safety throughout clinical development. And in addition, the medical officer has to kind of take into consideration all the recommendations and conclusions from the other scientific disciplines to kind of make an overall risk-benefit assessment on a particular issue. So they have a pretty big responsibility. And then every review team always has a project manager. The project manager is kind of the administrator of the group. They make sure that we meet our deadlines. They make sure that we're following regulations in terms of the recommendations that we send to drug sponsors. And then they also facilitate the communications between FDA and the drug sponsors. So other possible duties include, of course, you have to remain up to date on new scientific concepts within your discipline and therapeutic area. Sometimes you have to perform consultative reviews that come up in other divisions. We participate in the development of regulatory guidance. Sometimes we conduct independent research of the published or sponsored data to help develop that regulatory guidance. And when I say independent research, this is kind of like a meta-analysis type research. It's not really sort of independent, you know, basic research like you would imagine in an academic setting. And sometimes we publish articles and give presentations at scientific conferences, and we continually interact with industry scientists and patient advocacy groups as well. And then, of course, we can participate in various focus groups or committees dedicated to improving basically the FDA regulatory practices. So I just put this up there just to show that we do publish. We are part of the the medical, scientific, and public health community. Again, they're not like your basic biology research papers. These are sort of more review type articles or general guidance on antiviral drug development or other kind of regulatory issues that might come up that are worthwhile to publish and present to the community. So as far as desired skills and experience go, I think number one, you have to be public health driven. I don't think you'll enjoy the job, and I don't think you'll be as effective in the job if you're not public health driven. You also have to be able to critically analyze, comprehend, and interpret scientific data. You have to learn and apply new scientific concepts as needed. I mean, we cover really a broad array of therapeutic areas, even within the specific review divisions. You have to be able to communicate very well, both written and orally. And you have to be self-motivated, organized, ability to multitask. I think of Rebecca's picture of the office. You know, we are a lot of times just sitting in our offices by ourselves, so we really have to be self-motivated to get through our workload. And you have to be willing to spend little or no time at the bench. This depends a little bit on the position within FDA. The Center for Biologics Evaluation and Research, CBER, I think the reviewers tend to be more involved at the bench than the CDER reviewers are. So it just kind of depends on the position within FDA, but for me, I've been at FDA for just over 2 years, and I have yet to see a bench, and I don't really expect to see one anytime soon either. Doctoral degree and postdoctoral experience are highly desired. I don't think there are any formal requirements that you have a PhD in postdoctoral experience, but I think you'll have a hard time getting a job without a PhD and at least some form of postdoctoral experience. And that could be a traditional academic postdoc, that can be maybe working a few years in industry, sort of on the industry side of things, and that can be really valuable experience for getting a job at FDA. How did I get here? I'm probably not going to go through this, but mainly my interests are in, public health. I've always had an interest in public health, and that's what really attracted me to this position. And along those same lines, I've had an interest in applied research, so basically applying research for a public health purpose. And then I just kind of developed a broad interest in virology as I was going through graduate school. Pretty much heard about salary and benefits, very much like the NIH story. If you're a PhD with postdoctoral experience, you'll come in at the GS-12 or GS-13 level, most likely. Other career benefits, again, impact on public health. It is an academically stimulating environment. There's a lot of on-site training because you're really not trained in how to do an FDA review off-site. There are certainly opportunities for continuing education. You can join the PHS Commission Corps. Reasonably flexible work schedule. There are telecommute options, which are fantastic. I actually work at home 2 days a week, which is great because I also have two young kids, so that's really nice to be able to, shut off my computer at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and just go play with my kids. And there's good promotion potential within the federal government. Our ceiling is more like GS-15. There is a path to going up to the GS-15 level at FDA. And then sometimes there are recruitment incentives, and it just kind of depends on the hiring environment at the time. And we are located at the White Oak campus, which is just outside of the D.C. Beltline, the notorious D.C. Beltline. Luckily, we're outside it, so I live north, so I don't have to drive on it every day, which is good. Unfortunately, unlike NIH, we don't have a metro stop, but at least we do have pretty good parking. And this is a new campus. This is basically the new headquarters for FDA as of, I think, essentially the late 1990s. But it's still continuing to be developed as we speak. And then I'll just leave you with some additional resources. Again, USA Jobs is where the positions are officially posted. Washington Post or other typical job posting websites will frequently post FDA openings as well. Thank you.